This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network, an interview podcast with authors writing in a diverse set of fields. My name is Cody Skahan, an anthropologist by training, and I'm starting an MA program in anthropology at the University of Iceland in August 2022 as a Leifur Eiríksson Fellow. My work focuses on the intersections of queerness, environmentalisms, and tourism in Iceland. My guest today likely needs no introduction, but regardless, I will do my best. Dr. Jonathan Crary is the Meyer Shapiro Professor of Modern Art and Theory at Columbia University in the Art History and Archaeology Department. He is a prolific art and culture critic and is the co-founder and co-editor of Zone Books. Professor Crary has been the recipient of the Guggenheim, Getty, Mellon, and National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships and has been a member of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. In 2005, his teaching and mentoring were recognized with a Distinguished Columbia Faculty Award. He is also the author of Techniques of the Observer on Vision and Modernity in the 19th Century, Suspensions of Perception, Attention, Spectacle, and Modern Culture, which was the winner of the 2001 Lionel Trilling Book Award, and 24/7, which was a finalist for the 2016 Terzani International Literary Prize. But today, we'll be discussing his new book, Scorched Earth, Beyond the Digital Age to a Post-Capitalist World. Welcome, Dr. Crary, and thanks for joining me. Did I miss anything?
One thing that that some people don't know about me is that my first degree that I got as a student was a BFA. That my original educational experience was at an art school where I did film and I did photography. So that it's always been it's a way in which my academic work has been inflected by that experience, of working in the darkroom, of working with other filmmakers and so on.
Sure. That definitely comes through in this book, I think, because you definitely, definitely things that you bring up that I wouldn't expect a normal person who hasn't worked in those fields to bring up. So you can definitely see that coming through and really enriching this book. Okay. So Scorched Earth primarily focuses on the internet and the internet's inseparability from 24/7 capitalism. So as a result, rather than being sort of this revolutionary site of digital commons, as was foretold, the internet is and was always to be caught up in sort of these processes of Americanization, colonization, massification, militarization, environmental exploitation and sort of the overall dehumanization of humans. And as Dr. Curry kind of describes it, it's perhaps like the most penetrating form of technology of capitalism into our lives. Is that kind of an accurate encapsulation?
Yeah, it is. I mean, obviously, I wrote the book with a certain set of objectives in mind, which one of which was not a dispassionate, objective, scholarly examination of it. But I really made the decision to go with a specific rhetorical project, which was, in a sense, not presenting both sides as academics were trained to do, but in a sense to intensify what some of the arguments are, or some of the ways in which we can understand what we're all experiencing today. I mean, you mentioned that I wrote a book called 24/7, and in many ways, this book is an outgrowth of that, because in 24/7, I talked about what are some of the consequences of inhabiting a world that's basically switched on all the time. In other words, 24/7 for me was the idea of a social world, but also a living environmental planet that has no time, no downtime, of living systems that are really deprived of that ability for recuperation, for restoration and renewal. And it was a different moment. It's amazing how things have I don't know, I was going to say gone downhill since then. But I think it's clearer, much clearer now, what are some of the consequences of a world that's never switched off. And that's why I chose the title, I mean, Scorched Earth, that if you don't turn the power off, things are going to get hot. But the heat is not literally about global warming. I mean, it is about that, but it's also about what happens to the way in which social forms, communities are impacted by that inability to, in a sense, have time to spend outside of all of the accumulative and all of the work-related imperatives that we're saddled with. So that's, you know, that's how I start out the book, is in a sense, okay, why don't you interject if you've got a question?
I don't really have a question, but I guess I can add a point here that I can kind of add on with that. Like a way that I really think you did a good job of encapsulating what you're kind of describing of this always turned on and how always being turned on kind of like separates us from each other is you kind of use the term the colonization of consciousness and kind of this idea. So we believe that we're like autonomous actors and responsible for our own needs and fulfillment of our needs and desires and everything. And we become super independent, but in like cut off from the rest of the community, feel like, you know, it's just kind of like the American consumer culture taken to the extreme. But in reality, it's obviously these very complex forms of like capitalism, especially through the internet, forcing us to like kind of driving our desires in some ways and in certain directions. So I thought that was a very evocative phrasing for that. And the way you explain it is just so amazing. I really like it.
Well, part of what I wanted to do in terms of the, of what some people have already called the relentlessness of my argument is I wanted to in a sense, effect a kind of defamiliarization of the circumstances and arrangements that we're living within, that is to suggest the ways in which they're not necessarily here to stay. And in fact, I use that phrase a number of times in the book about different institutions, different social arrangements, different technological arrangements that are presented to us as these inevitabilities, as these, in a sense, historically determined facts that are irrevocable. And that's part of what I was hoping that I could get across with the way in which I use my prose in the book, is to insist that, not that we're ever going to, this is getting into prediction, but I never say that we're going to live in a world where there's no digital technology, but I'm suggesting that if we're going to be inhabiting a livable and shareable world, those technological arrangements will be marginalized. They won't be the center pieces of our lives. So some of the historical background for the book is looking at the 1990s, after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union, when it seemed as if global market capitalism, free market, the so-called free market democracies, it was often presented as the end of history, as though this is the way things are going to be indefinitely. And clearly, events have shown that that was not the case. Like 9/11 was a huge wake-up call that revealed that there was far more conflict, far more unresolved antagonisms in the world. And even in the year and a half since I finished the book, I mean, it's amazing the kinds of events that have happened. We don't even know what's happening now in terms of the breakup of what we once thought was a globalized planet, with this vision now of a world that's splitting in two, of Russia and China on one side and the US and Europe on the other. Because that certainly is an abandonment of those fantasies of a world that would be harmoniously unified by digital communications and internet contact. So, even in the time since I've written the book, there's clear evidence of the fragility and the, in a sense, the precariousness of arrangements that had been presented to us as unchangeable. That's just one example. Because for me, it's far more important is the untenability of certain technological arrangements in relationship to how we relate to other people, how we build communities that are capable of supporting each other. Those are the crucial arenas or milieus where we will see new forms of socialization emerge. I mean, they're already happening in the global South and in indigenous communities. I think some of us in cities like New York, we don't have direct contact with some of the new directions that are being staked out by people in some of the most damaged parts of the planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what really strikes me with what a lot of what you're saying and what's in the book is kind of this the kind of generational part aspect of it as well, because it's like you talk about how young people are just so shut off from like anything else. Like personally for me, since I was born, the internet has existed. And in school, like from the time I was pretty young, I was socialized with the internet and all these things. So it can be even more difficult for me and people of my generation and similar ages to kind of like you're saying, imagine something differently or get outside of this, which I think is kind of ties in well with what you were saying earlier about like looking at indigenous communities and how they're having these forms of organizing. Because in the book, you also talk about just considering the sort of vast timescale of human history and looking at these and saying, okay, so there's alternate forms of arranging ourselves, and we've done it without the internet and without technology for so long. So like, how can we get back to these? Looking forward, what new ones might come out from just, experimenting with different forms of living as well, which I really appreciate how open-ended that is for you, because you talk about like each community kind of figuring out for themselves. So I think that's just like, Yeah, personally, I think that's the way towards the future too. So I guess, yeah, with that question, I guess that kind of this kind of goes back to the beginning of the book where you talk about the idea, your sort of point of the book, you write, is to give voice to what is experienced in common, to what is known or partly known in common, but is negated by an overpowering barrage of messages that insist on the unalterability of our administered lives. So going along with that, what would you say is kind of like the audience, or who are you speaking for? Or what kind of gap are you trying to fill here with this?
Well, I don't know whether I've completely succeeded or not. That's really what I'll find out in terms of who the readers of the book ultimately are. But I didn't want to write for an academic audience. I mean, I've written books that are in academic prose that in a sense that use the models of academic scholarship. And with 24/7, I think I started to do that, in a sense to imagine a crossover kind of vocabulary. I mean, I obviously can never completely abandon the ways in which my thinking has been formed, but I really tried in terms of my vocabulary and my reluctance to, in a sense, get too deeply involved in some of the contemporary theoretical debates that are going on. So the idea of addressing people who may in private have certain doubts, certain misgivings, certain threshold of despair about the limitations and a kind of impoverishment of their individual lives. Because in other words, that idea of we're inundated with declarations of how great the internet is and that this is the way in which we relate to other people. So, I think we all do. I'm certainly not exempt from the habitual way in which I engage these tools that are in front of me literally right now. But in other words, I'm trying to allow people to begin to pursue some of those, you know, maybe even barely verbalized kinds of doubts or misgivings or intuitions of the inadequacy of how one is connecting with other people. One of the historical figures that I draw on is the revolutionary leader and theorist Rosa Luxemburg, who was most active around the time of the Russian Revolution and then in the years immediately following the failed revolution in Germany. But she noted as clearly as anybody in who was analyzing capitalism was the need for capitalism to continually eliminate and close off even the visibility of alternative ways of living or alternative ways of working. And that's partly what this whole process of the expansion of what becomes integrated into online routines from routines that had existed in offline ways for hundreds of years. So it's, we're getting to a point now where there will be fewer and fewer significant social worlds or social arenas of interaction that are offline, that are unmonitored, so to speak. I don't want to be too extreme because obviously we can all point to some of those. But what I'm trying to indicate is the dynamic or the logic that's at work that in fact needs to be resisted. It also goes to the way in which the word technology is used, which is something I'm always on the receiving end of. People say, oh, you're against technology. No, that's absurd. But what I am against is the incredible limitations and restrictions that are put on how that word is used. The word technology has come to mean a very small slice of what we could think of as techniques or technologies in the long historical framework of how that word is used. So that if someone is, you know, called a technophobe or they're against technology, what it finally means is that they are critical of the offerings of a handful of global tech corporations. You know, you're anti-technology if in one way or another you are critical or refusing of what Google or Facebook or Apple, whatever, offers. So, it's no wonder that there's a kind of informal enforcement of critics of that particular sphere. So, I mean, you know, the word technique, as a number of interest, some of our best historians and theorists have pointed out, you know, has been with human society as long as it's existed. So that, you know, one has to be thinking not necessarily just about old or indigenous techniques, but of a kind of mix of alternate possibilities for the way in which materials can be used, the ways in which living arrangements and communication systems can be understood. So, you know, that's what I'm trying to shake up is to get away from that narrow way in which certain terms are used and deployed.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, of course. Like the policing of language, and especially on like online spaces of like how we use technology. This sounds very like Jacques Ellul to me, inspired by his use of like how he uses technique and how he in the technological society and things like this. It's like this expansive form of exploring different ways of what technique can mean. As you say, it's like if the internet and these other like technologies are so like invasive parts of our lives, or like they're just a part of everything, even if some sort of, you know, we're organizing even an in-person conversation, we'll probably use the internet to communicate and arrange this. But like a more expansive form of the word technology can open up, like you say, new possibilities of like, oh, we can use other forms of technology to communicate and organize and meet up together. Which I guess for me, that opens up the question of thinking about like maybe more in terms of like labor strikes and labor unions and organizations like these. Like oftentimes, as we've seen throughout history, like, you know, May 68, all these other things, like obviously they weren't relying on the internet to organize. So do you see that like in the future, for example, for labor unions and these other sort of different way, do you see in labor unions and these sort of practices and these sorts of institutions, like is this one of these areas that you're thinking, oh, we can pull inspiration from them on different ways to like communicate and create community and outside of this sort of internet technology bubble?
Well, I can't say I'm hugely informed about contemporary labor movement, but obviously a lot of workers are looking for ways to have more autonomy in the ways in which their lives are organized and the way in which the very conditions of labor are organized. But I mean, part of what I'm, you know, posing in the book is the possibility of some dramatic are some pretty dramatic transformations that are not that far off. People who are involved in various progressive and environmental kinds of activism, we're all looking towards a future in which growth ceases to be the kind of dominant imperative in terms of how an economy is organized. So there are people who are looking at a no growth future. There are people who are looking at the Green New Deal, are looking at a whole range of visions of a very different kind of future that in one way or another could contribute to a survivable planet. But what I'm pointing out is that, I mean, this is comes from a lot of reading of work that's come out of those movements, but also talking with people, that what I'm partly challenging is the sort of unexamined assumption that the internet and social media will persist alongside whatever sorts of reforms remakings of the economy. And to me, there's something, there's a kind of cognitive dissonance there, because the internet and social media, the only reason they survive is through the existence of mega global corporations like Apple, like Google, like Facebook. So, you know, I think what we all share is a vision of how the world could survive in the absence of those dominant corporate institutions. That basically, if those institutions are and corporations are still here in 20 years, it means that we won't have succeeded in changing anything. So, I mean, I you know, I'm not an economist, and I'm not, you know, I can't say my environmental knowledge is that of any expert, but I mean, there's a kind of common sense logic to what I'm projecting, so that if we're really thinking about a survivable and humane future, we really have to think about what will be some of the underlying conditions that could support that reality. So to get back to your thing about your question about labor unions, the very way in which work and labor will be happening will be, you know, hopefully will be outside of those top-down hierarchical corporate models, and they'll be that in various regions of the planet there'll be new ways in which collective projects, whether it's for affordable housing, whether it's for clean water systems, you know, whether it's for the local food production. I mean, those are just some of the basics. I mean, this is not me posing these, but of just this is common sense. And I mean common sense in the deep root of that word common, because you know, one of the things that neoliberal capitalism has persisted in doing is denying countries the ability to be self-subsisting. You know, any country that starts to institute land reform, in other words, of wanting to have their own food production under their own control, it's that's absolutely prohibited. that poor countries have to be even more enslaved to economic control that's outside of their hands. So that's why those things of housing, water and food, I mean, and some kind of healthcare that's available in an equitable way. I mean, you know, everything else, in a sense, has to come after that.
Yeah, of course. Yes. As you say, like, I'm somewhat versed in the commons literature, although maybe not as I think I am. Of course, with like Silvia Federici is one of the big names. And she focuses largely on places in Africa that have create their own forms of commons or have historical commons that they're sort of like continuing to bring and use in the present. And just, I guess, interestingly, I think although in the West, there's definitely historically been forms of commons, especially like I'm thinking of like sort of feudal England before enclosement and things like this. So, and you talk about capitalism and neoliberal capitalism directly infringing on these forms of commons. So I think this common sort of idea, and people well, like on the left largely in academics, are like fairly amenable to the term commons and kind of understand what that means and are like, yes, this is a great idea. But with like maybe a little bit broader society, do you think there's this struggle in sort of maybe articulating to them the importance of these sort of common structures, or these like these may exist, right? Like they exist in different forms, like churches and churches that support like food drives and all these things. So do you think there's some sort of like translation perhaps that needs to be done of like this sort of this church charity drive is essentially a basic form of commons, and this is the kind of things that we need to bring together more. So yeah, is there some sort of translation thing here, or are those like completely different ideas in your eyes?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure whether we need to get completely hung up on that specific word. I mean that there could be enterprises, there could be local efforts at various goals that from a certain perspective would have that commons character. I think that we have to look at a whole range of activities, as I've said, many of which are already taking place in some of the most vulnerable and precarious communities around the planet, whether it's around sea level rise. I mean, some of the organizing that's gone on some of the Pacific islands that are the most threatened by sea level rise, or whether it's in communities in South Asia where the way in which agriculture is organized, in a sense, fighting for the control over the traditional forms that food raising has taken for centuries, as opposed to the global food and chemical fertilizer companies that are coming in and completely devastating those long-standing relationships of people to the land. So that, you know, what forms those will take in places like Europe and North America, again, I think it's going to really depend on different regions. I mean, already Southern Europe, of what over the past 10, 20 years in Greece and in certain parts of Spain, you know, of neighborhoods that in certain ways have organized themselves around specific objectives, or sometimes what they'll call neighborhood assemblies. They fluctuated, in terms of the relationship to specific historical moments of crisis, at least in recent years. So it's tough to come up with some sort of larger overarching characterization. And just in response to your question.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, of course. Because, yeah, there's, I think some of the ones that are perhaps very well known or maybe kind of come through a little bit more in other like forms of media include like Rojava in North and East Syria, and then, of course, like Athens, the traditional sort of commons and practices that have been done there. So it's, yeah.
But
go ahead.
You're absolutely right to foreground the work of Silvia Federici. I mean, you know, if you've read the book, so you know that I cite her, and, I'm just an extraordinary activist, but also an extraordinary theorist. But it's someone, she's, her writing is something, it speaks to people who may have no connection with the academic world. There's a kind of clarity about how she presents, what could be very complex kinds of questions and phenomena. But there's no question after you've read a book by her to know what some of one's priorities need to be.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Sure. Yeah. And I think the way that Federici articulates this sort of idea of the commons or whatever language you kind of want to use, like you're saying, I don't think the language is so important as sort of recognizing, I guess, a little bit like of different forms of how what this can take place, as you kind of mentioned, and seeing this throughout the historical record and even in contemporary times. I think all of that's great. So I want to change focus a little bit here to kind of maybe hone in a little bit more on the idea of like scorched earth, the concept that you use of a scorched earth. You kind of write, a scorched earth is the stifling of hope, the canceling of the possibility that the world could be restored or healed. This crushing of belief in renewal is perpetuated through the capturing and disempowering of the youth. So this idea of scorched earth is, I don't know if you've read Anna Singh's work, but kind of she has this idea of like living in the capitalist ruins. So it's about sort of after maybe whatever happens, we sort of have these practices that we can rely on, or even things that kind of like come from the desolation. So she talks about mushroom gathering after land like have been completely destroyed by like radioactivity from like the nuclear bombs, for example. Just in terms of like, yes, this idea of perhaps living in the ruins, is this sort of part perhaps what you're trying to capture with scorched earth a bit of like, even if we don't completely succeed in everything that we may set out to do, and like humans survive, but there's, you know, we do some sort of devastation to the earth, or it's, you know, left bereft of a lot of the natural resources that we've been lucky enough to have, that there's still these sorts of practices you're mentioning. Maybe they're perhaps let us still exist in another form. Is this kind of maybe an idea of what you're trying to capture with scorched earth, or is there more you want to add to that?
That's definitely some really valuable observations. I mean, I use the word partly because I did a little etymological research because I was interested in how long that word has been around in English and what some of the roots of it were, and I came up with the understanding that to scorch something is not to completely immolate it. I mean, you know, to scorch something isn't to completely burn it up. At least this is one definition of it. That to scorch a surface is to kind of singe a surface. And one of the definitions that I came across was to scorch or singe a surface in such a way that its color eradicated, which really connected with me, partly because I'm involved in art and the history of art. So I was really thinking about the ways in which some of what we're experiencing now is about that damage and degradation to what we think of as color. Maybe not in a literal optical sense, but color in a broader way of the affects that in a sense give our life some some kind of joy or some kind of quiet exhilaration in terms of how we connect with others, even how we connect with animals or the natural world and so on. So that's, you know, I mentioned that at a certain point in the book. So that it is, I mean, scorched earth is also, it's about damage to the point where renewal is either made impossible or made very, very difficult. And that was one of the reasons why youth would be, at least in a social or even anthropological sense, of the way in which that living element of a human world, which is it's youth, the sort of flowering, if one wants to think of all of the metaphors that one could bring into it, is a concerted set of arrangements that prevent young people from, in a sense, understanding who they are in a temporal and generational sense. And again, it's not so much that young people are made to grow up really quickly, but it's that closing off of what for thousands of years had been part of what it meant to be, of what youth meant in terms of exploration of all different facets of life, driven by a kind of sense of wonderment or exhilaration, and so on. I mean, I know this seems a little hyperbolic because obviously, you know, we've been living in societies where, you know, young people have been subject to deprivation and difficult circumstances of all kinds. So I'm not saying there's something totally new happening, but what is happening is that narrowing through digital technologies and social media of closing down some of those experiences that, at least to my mind, are kind of essential for in a sense self-knowledge and self-understanding, and of the ways in which you build a world in partnership with people that you're friends with, that you love, and so on. So that's happening in different ways, different parts of the planet. So I'm not trying to, you know, pose some completely homogenous characterization. But I do say one of the things I say is that music, in spite of the ways in which music is, you know, a commodity and it's sort of homogenous, that it's interesting. That still is one of the few ways in which young people have come to some way of understanding their own uniqueness and their own the own way, it's a kind of ways in which their relation to the world is mediated. And it's interesting. I mean, for me, I mean, I may be wrong about this, but that's my hunch. I think other people agree with me as well, that there's something so kind of fundamental about that relationship to music that it's not capable of being completely appropriated, so to speak.
Sure. Yeah. So just kind of picking up the sort of thread of like scorched earth with the aspect of like draining the color from something, and just kind of this overall picture you're pointing of like this kind of disconnection from humans and nature and each other and all these things, towards in the latter half of the book and in the last chapter, you really seem to focus on specifically like the eyes, the voice, and the face, and sort of like how these are like we're being like sensorially deprived and capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, and through the internet and all these things is like sort of remaking our senses, or like using sort of these hacks of our senses to make us hyper aware of certain things and pay attention to these sorts of things. So like, could you, I guess, talk a little bit about how this sort of like, this sort of separation from like, or this change perhaps of the way that we sense the world through our eyes, our voice, the face, and these things kind of like change our relationship to each other and our relationship to like the community and things like this a little bit more?
Oh, that's great. I'm glad you asked that question because it ties into some of the earlier parts of our discussion. You know, what is it that enables or is the ground for the emergence of a world that's shared, of a world in common, so to speak? So I kind of talk about the importance of what some philosophers or others call an encounter, which the way in which that notion of the encounter has been articulated is about the in a sense the fundamental importance of the face as an element. And here, you know, this would not mean what we're doing right now. It would be a notion of face to face that would be about that physical proximity. So basically, I'm looking at the face and the gaze and the eyes. So the three things: the face, the gaze, and the voice. That for me, and I think you know, for many other people, they're kind of core, kind of irreducible elements of a world that we could think of as an interhuman world. In other words, if you don't have those elements in some way, and obviously I would mean to compensate for any disability that was bound up in those. So I'm not trying to essentialize them in that sense, but of the ways in which proximity and speech and touch obviously could be part of that as well, although I didn't introduce that into it. So I'm looking at the ways in which there's a kind of instrumentalization and even mechanization of those three things that's intensifying, that's increasing. A lot of, in some ways, it doesn't seem all that threatening, I think, to a lot of people, the way in which we'll talk to digital personal assistants or to robotic voices. But my sense is that extended and kind of ongoing a pervasiveness of talking, for example, to robotic voices, there is something that damages. There's something damaging about that over the long term, and it's a kind of impoverishment because I think once we begin to talk to robots, there's a way in which we make our own voices into something that's depleted. It's depleted of the kind of feeling, the kind of emotion that we use to talk to real people. And it's also just the way in which our face has become kind of instrumentalized in so many different ways, you know, especially faces that have a kind of obligatory smile on them. I also talk about the iris and the whole technology of iris scanning, which transforms the iris from something almost a bit magical in terms of the way in which you can locate something incredibly unique in the gaze of another person. One of the things that I, as you know from reading the book, is that I'm far more concerned about what's happening to those elements of a life world or an interhuman world than I am about digital surveillance. You know, there's a lot that's been written recently about so-called surveillance capitalism, which it's not like I don't think it's not important, but I think by focusing on data mining and digital surveillance, that the end result is simply to make us even more protective and privatized and isolated and enclosed, rather than looking at some of the more profound ways in which we're in a sense being I want to be very careful, I'm not exaggerating, but I think what's at stake is a more, it's not so much control, but it's a kind of diminishing of what some of our capacities as human beings are, which I actually find more disturbing ultimately than the idea that we're being somehow manipulated and controlled, because I think that there's a way in which at least we can consciously think about resisting, whereas sometimes we don't really see the little increments by which we're drained of some of our abilities to empathize and to connect with other people.
Sure. Yeah. And I really appreciate in the book how it's very understandable. Like, it's easy to read, but it's not like a lot of books and sort of things writing about the internet or people talking, just kind of generalize about the internet and technology and say, oh, it's depriving you of your senses. It's, you know, making you desensitized to things. And just the kind of more like, I appreciate the sort of like almost viscerality too of like how you're talking about our like senses, our natural capacities and how the iris and just with nature, like the beautiful colors of nature and everything, that there's some sort of like you're trying to almost reinvoke the sense of like wonderment and wake us up to it and see that like this is what we're losing. Like it's not some sort of just general sensory perception of things, but it's like this specific idea of wonderment and capacity for seeing the natural beauty of things and seeing each other as humans. This is what's kind of being sort of changed and like you say, diminished. Which I really appreciate in its sort of complexity and kind of refusing to just sort of cop out with the generalizations.
Right. No, Cody, I'm glad. Yeah. I'm glad that as a reader that you connected with that, because the book starts out and again, I think I used the word, it's a pretty relentless overview of the digital world that we're inhabiting. But when I get to the third chapter, I tried to do something very different in terms of talking more directly about ways in which we can hold on to certain elements of our lives and of the ways in which our lives are kind of in inseparable from those of other people, regardless of how broken or deteriorated they become. So that's one of the reasons I didn't really focus. I mean, I made a point of introducing the work of philosophers and social theorists and writers of many different kinds from you know, even 100 or more years ago, that I didn't want to simply focus on who were some of the important people who've been writing in the last 10, 20 years, even though I did name a few. But I mean, so that's why somebody like Rosa Luxemburg or the philosopher Martin Buber, especially important for me, or I know Hannah Arendt is in there, or the French social thinker Simone Weil, who wrote during World War II, or even some of the late work of the philosopher Husserl. I mean, I could go on, but I really wanted to convey the idea that it isn't that we can still learn. We can learn an incredible amount from people who were already thinking about some of the ways in which modernizing institutions began a much longer term process of, in a sense, incorporating individual human beings into these different systems and imposing these different imperatives about how people relate to each other. So it was important for me to have that longer historical framework as well. You know, that it's not as though this started 20 years ago.
Sure. Yeah. 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 For one, I think your use of Martin Buber is really interesting, especially because I've read a few books and articles and things by Martin Buber, but it seems like I don't know. I'm not sure why, but like, it doesn't really come up a lot. People don't cite him so much from the stuff I read mostly. And I think just sort of like his conceptualization is so like really like the philosophical approach to things that he takes of like the like I and thou and all of these things. It's like it strikes very much a chord with like what you're kind of trying to encapsulate in your book and like sort of this just like I don't know, this deep like humanism almost of it. And
right. I mean, people forget that Buber was a socialist and that everything he did was geared towards the possibility of a more human community. That it was never, he did write that book called I and Thou, but his ultimate concerns were about ways in which a kind of socialist community. He never thought it would be perfect. He never thought it was ever going to be, you know, finally realized. But he just posed that idea of a shaping community forms of living together as a goal. I mean, as a kind of regulative goal, and including, you know, some of the other people that I discuss in the book would have shared some of those ambitions at that time as well.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay. Yeah. So just sort of, I think I have sort of a last kind of sum up question that it may be a little complex and maybe too much to ask for one person to put this, all the burden of this on your shoulders. But as you state, your goal is to touch some part in people who say, you know, sort of have this feeling or something, realization that something's wrong, like that we need to do something else. It's kind of a two-part question. So, one, how do you sort of like in your book, you, towards the end, you describe like these ideas of like forming these, like what we were talking about earlier with the commons, like just different forms of bringing people together to generate these sort of healthcare, food and all these resources that we need. So how do we for one get people who have these feelings to actually like sort of change these feelings into action outside of like, you know, I don't know, like maybe you think writing these types of books is to do or maybe, you know, showing by doing. And then I guess sort of a related second question is how do we get people who are so just still so saturated in the internet and maybe somewhat convinced by your defilmization sort of technique, which I think is great. How do we get them to actually sort of leave the internet space or leave this sort of like digital space and kind of, you know, as they say, touch grass or really engage in like this sort of, I don't know, the sort of activities you described.
Right. Those are really tough questions. And I wish I had some easy answers. I mean, I think part of what's going to, I mean, people are going to respond more directly as events in a sense take a more obvious turn towards the transformation of the world that we're living in now. I mean, I don't want to be prescriptive in saying that there's a specific agenda that people have to follow, but you know, and it's going to take different forms, different regions, different communities. I mean, part of what I'm sharing with other people is the sense that the Western organization of society and the economy is in a sense beyond repair, so that there's going to be an inevitable way in which people are going to look beyond the promises of that, that in a sense that we've been living with, and who knows what's happening right now in terms of the deterioration of some of the assurances that we've been living with about you know, just sort of the basic ingredients of a livable life. I mean, I've always had some doubts about the way, I mean, for example, the demonstrations that take place, whether it's by the so-called Extinction Rebellion people, more in England than here, but of really whether those efforts are misplaced to some extent by in a sense, asking the powers that be to transform themselves, and expecting that some change is going to come in that hierarchical top-down setup, as opposed to in a sense reorganizing the ways in which the individual lives of the people in those demonstrations or those movements are figured at this point. So I mean, that's, you know, I'm hardly the only person to have to point it to that, but it's the very very composition of what protest is, of what resistance is, that in a sense has to shift from asking and demanding from powers that be to constituting one's own community, one's own group, one's own region, in ways that pose other forms of existence, other forms of living together. I mean, I that's not a you know, it's not a direct answer to what sure. you're about.
It's kind of a very hard to answer question. And I think if anyone had the answer, then, like, you know, conversations like this wouldn't, you know, have to happen as much. If no one holds all the answers, and the best we can do is sort of to, like, chip at it and do our best to broach and get people. And I'm in complete agreement of the, you know, the inefficacy of the sort of relying on these top-down structures to try to, you know, appeal to these top-down structures, because fundamentally it's not in their best interest to change. Whereas it's, of course, in the best interest of each individual person, especially when we sort of try to generate the sorts of communities that you describe. So I think you're pushing people and writing and thinking and definitely 100% the right direction. And
right. Well, people often ask me, they'd say, well, are you hopeful? I mean, it's a word that is pretty urgent right now. I mean, a lot of debates are about, you know, the degree to which one should express pessimism, or the degree to which one is entitled to be hopeful. I mean, my sense, I mean, just stupid, we can kind of, it's just as a kind of concluding remark, is that hope shouldn't really be thought of so much as an attitude that one can choose to either take on or not. That for me, hopefulness is something that's completely inseparable from working together in some type of shared world. In other words, that hope doesn't, at least in the ways in which I think of hope as meaningful, it doesn't really exist as an individual attitude that's kind of enclosed, but that hope manifests itself within shared enterprises and shared projects that are about at least some vision of an alternate world, or of a world that could possibly emerge, so that it takes it out of that, you know, that idea of simply an attitude.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and just to sort of go along with that, your book is certainly not. I wouldn't call it either utopian or dystopian in nature. Like, it kind of tacks between. It doesn't describe this perfect world that we're going to achieve. It's sort of this realistic, but as you say, hopeful tone to it of we can do something. There's something to do. So it's not completely foreclosing off of the future, like many people feel is the way that the world is and the only attitude they can take, which is, of course, as you say, very complex and difficult thing we all have to sort of deal with. So thanks for joining me, Dr. Jonathan Crary, and thank you for turning into the New Books Network, everyone. So make sure to check out Dr. Crary's book, Scorched Earth, Beyond the Digital Age to a Post-Capitalist World. Can you say about where people can find this book sort of the best way people can find this book?
I encourage people to buy it at the local bookstores in my neighborhood and Upper West Side of New York City. If you're near a bookstore, go tell them to order it for you if they don't have it. So I'm avoiding suggesting another way to get it. I'm not mentioning it.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, definitely. Well, I appreciate you for joining me. And this is your host, Cody Skahan, signing off for now.